everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
All right. Good morning, Discovery Church. It is good to be with you today. My name's Zach. I'm one of the pastors here. A couple things before we get into our teaching today. Don't mind my diffuser. I'm just feeling a little posh today. That'll come up a little bit later on. As we're entering into this time in the summer, this will be the last week that I share this with us, but we typically get our children's ministry volunteers the summer off, which means that we need a lot of help down there. So again, last Sunday that I'll be sharing this, but I would just love, if you're able, there's a sign-up sheet on the way out the door. Also, there's another one down in the basement. But if there's one or two weeks this summer where you could just say, yeah, we could come for one service and serve in children's ministry, and then we could attend normal service, that would be great, and then we could give these folks really well-deserved rest. Also, another announcement that I'll make, and then last week on this, but a few weeks ago, we wrapped up our series called Right on the Money with a very simple request that for anyone who calls Discovery home, if you're not a monthly giver to what's going on around here, we would just like to ask that you would consider that. And if that's like five, if you're like, I can do $5, that's phenomenal. But building that side of a monthly base will help us a lot as we're getting ready to enter into our budgeting season as we're thinking about next year. Final announcement, happy Father's Day to you dads in the room. Yeah, that's worth an applause. I know that for many of us, today will be a great day of celebrating the dads in our lives. I know for some of us too. And I think this is a real value for me. We're a church that one of our values is celebration and lament. And some of you, this Father's Day is your first Father's Day without your dad. And I just want to recognize you, and that today might really be difficult. And for some of you, talking about your dad is a really hard thing, because that's not a relationship that was super helpful in your life. And that underlying all of that is a lot of grief. And so wherever you are as you're coming into this room today, into Father's Day, you are welcome here. And I think this is a place where God would say, I have some thoughts about what it means to be a dad. And we'll be leaning into that together. All right, you guys, we're continuing on in our series in the book of Leviticus. This is week 2. Before we get too far into today's particular teaching, if you missed last week, we set up what is going on in this epic book in the Bible. And the whole book's structure is really important to us as we talk about what we're going to be doing each week. So this was one of the things that we talked about last week. It's built like a chiasm, which is kind of this like word sandwich. The way that Leviticus begins and ends have some very similar themes. And then the second idea and the second to last idea, very, very similar. It's built like a funnel. And the book of Leviticus is trying to get you down to this main point. The whole book of Leviticus is about everything that's going on in there, but the point is this idea of atonement. So each week as we're going through this series from here on out, we'll just be going one layer down at a time. So today we're up here at this layer talking about rituals. And as we look at the first few chapters of Leviticus, we're talking about ritual sacrifices. As we get into the last several chapters, we're talking about ritual festivals or parties. Today we're going to be spending more time talking about the sacrifices, which I like might be like, why are we doing that? Let's talk about the fun stuff. If you were here a few years ago, we had a whole series called Party On, where we went through one of these festivals at a time. If you're like, get me into some of the party stuff, it is all there waiting for you. If you need help finding that, just let us know. But this week we're going to hone in on this sacrifice idea. And I usually don't do this. I will save this till the end to just be like, summary, what have we just talked about? But I want to give it to you on the front end because this is thick, what we're headed into today. There's three big ideas that pop out when we talk about this idea of ritual sacrifice, and it's these. One, this is about repairing a relationship. So start to think about that's what's driving this. That's the point behind these sacrifices. Second, this is about getting near to God. And then finally, when we talk about ritual sacrifices, this extends beyond a mandatory invitation and becomes something that is actually drawing us further into awe. And I think sometimes when we look at the book of Leviticus, if you've ever read this before, you can get stuck in like, man, there's just so many rules. And there's just so much more going on here than rules. So with all of that said, let's get into our reading for today. For those who brought your Bibles, you can turn to Leviticus chapter 1, starting in verse 1. We're right at the kickoff of this thing. And if you have a Bible at home, I would recommend every single week. That would be a great thing to bring with you. But particularly as we're going through these series that we're studying the book, bring it with you. Leviticus 1, starting in verse 1. The Lord summoned Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, 'When any of you bring an offering of livestock to the Lord, you shall bring your offering from the herd or from the flock. If the offering is a burnt offering from the herd, you shall offer a male without blemish. You shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting for acceptance in your behalf before the Lord. You shall lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be acceptable in your behalf as atonement for you. The bull shall be slaughtered before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall offer the blood, dashing the blood against all sides of the altar at the entrance of the tent of meeting. The burnt offering shall be flayed and cut up into parts. The sons of the priest of Aaron shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Aaron's sons, the priests, shall arrange the parts with the head and the suet, that's like the fat around the organs, on the wood that is on the fire of the altar, but its entrails and its legs shall be washed with water. Then the priest shall turn the whole into smoke on the altar as a burnt offering, an offering by fire of pleasing odor to the Lord." Man, we may have read that and you're like, why are we studying this book? I'm delighted to be getting into this teaching today. So much of what's going on when we talk about ritual sacrifices is really just asking us the question, where do we put our ugliness? Not like unattractiveness, like where do we put our gunk, our stuff, our trash, our waste, the nastiness of life? And I think as good Westerners, as good Americans, we are really talented as a culture of hiding this stuff, getting it far, far away from us. When you think about something like our sewer system, where do we put our waste? Far away, we never really have to think about it all that much. What about just our trash? Same idea. Once a week, it's out on the curb. Like, my neighbors can tell what we've been up to sometimes, but it gets taken far away, and I never have to see it again. I wonder if some of this wasn't what was at the root of the story that Oscar Wilde wrote in the late 1800s called A Picture of Dorian Gray. And if you've never heard this story before, it's probably for good reason. This was by far his most controversial work. It's pretty graphic, and he got a lot of heat for it. But the story of Dorian Gray goes like this. Dorian Gray was this really attractive young Englishman. And one day, he's convinced by a guy named Lord Henry to become a hedonist, that his life should be spent just pursuing joy and happiness and the feeling of feeling good. Anything beautiful, that's what he wanted to be about. And he had just had this portrait of himself painted by his friend Basil, and he just had brought this portrait home and had put it in his front entryway. And Dorian decides that he wants to make a deal with the devil. So he has this conversation and he says, "Look, to be a hedonist, I'm battling this ultimate problem because I'm going to die. I'm going to lose my ability to sense joy and beauty and just happiness in the world. And I don't want to do that. So can I live forever? And can something else age and take the damage in my place?" And the devil says, "Well, sure. How about the portrait? For every bad thing that happens in your life, the damage will actually happen to the portrait instead of to you. You can stay young and beautiful and live forever." And Dorian says, "Well, that's perfect." So it's not long after that that he goes to see a play. It's a Shakespearean play. The actress that's like the main actress, he just falls head over heels for her. And they date for a while. As a good hedonist does, they kind of do all the things that you do when you're in a romantic relationship. Until the day comes when he's like, "I'm just kind of done. I'm over you. You're not like doing it for me anymore." And dumps her pretty hard and finds out not long after that she has committed suicide. And he finds himself sneering at her. And for the first time when he goes home that night, he finds that the portrait of himself now has this really ugly, cruel sneer going on. And he really doesn't like it. So he does two things following this moment. One is he takes this portrait and he decides, "I am locking this away. I don't want to see it. Like, it's disgusting. That sneer, I resent it. So I'm going to lock up this portrait." And for 18 years, he doesn't see the portrait, locks it away. But the other thing that he does is he realizes love is costly if you're a hedonist. Because there's so many things about love, the further in that you go, that just don't feel that good anymore. And I just want to feel good because I'm a hedonist. So he decides, "I'm done with love."
And for the next 18 years, he chases every sort of vice that you could possibly think of. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, the whole shooting match. And one day his friend Basil, the one who had drawn the portrait, confronts him on his life. He's just like, dude, you are just leaving carnage everywhere behind you. The wake behind your lifestyle is horrendous. And Dorian says, well, no, it's not, because all of the damage is going somewhere else. And Basil cannot understand. And so finally Dorian says, look, because you're the one who drew it, like, this will make sense to you. And for the first time in 18 years, he pulls out the portrait, and it's hideous. Like, unrecognizable. The only way that Basil could tell that that was the actual painting that he'd drawn was because Basil's signature was in the bottom corner. But otherwise, it looked nothing like Dorian. It was horrible. In a moment of confrontation, Basil just says, you have to stop living this way. Like, this is a representation of what your life looks like. And Dorian freaks out, and he stabs him. He kills him. And as Dorian's life just kind of represents, just this really ugly response even to that, he calls a friend who's a chemist and secures some chemicals so that he can literally dissolve Basil's body, kind of another, like, micro metaphor of this whole story. Basil is gone and finally goes back home and is left confronting this portrait. And it's just so horrible. And the resentment that Dorian feels, he just wants the portrait to be gone. So he takes a knife and he stabs the portrait. And the story ends with this wild twist. And it's a total spoiler alert. If you want to go read it, plug your ears. But he stabs this portrait. And this magical twist of fate, the police roll up on scene the next day to find a shriveled old man with a dagger in his chest and a beautiful painting of a young man on the floor next to him. Where do we put our trash and our waste? I think sometimes as Americans, and I think, like, Dorian Gray is such an interesting story because it's such an out of sight, out of mind. I don't have to worry about it anymore. But what happens when we do have to worry about it? What happens when you're confronted with a sewer that backs up, or trash that doesn't get picked up, or we actually put watermelon and some old chicken in a very hot garage for a week before the trash came? And all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is gross. And then what happens when we're talking about more than just body waste or food waste? What happens when we're talking about the ugliness of our lives? We don't like seeing our mess. We want a place to hide it, to get it out of the way. We just want life to stay in some sense of harmony. What do we do? And as we get into this idea of ritual sacrifice, I think what we find is a God who's saying, I can smell it and I can see it, all of it, all the time. And it just seems so wrong to let it pile up around you. What if we could clean you off every now and again? What if we could actually keep things so clean that we can actually, you and I, God and I, can do life together? Let me read our passage one more time today, and I'll just ask you to be considering this as we go throughout our morning. This passage, literally the first 9 verses of our book, the first 7 chapters are discussing all of these different kinds of ritual sacrifice. This is really just like the tip of the iceberg on one of them, but I think there's Leviticus is so well written. It gives us all the highlights that we're going to need to understand ritual sacrifice in these first 9. Here it is again. The Lord summoned Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any of you bring an offering of livestock to the Lord, you shall bring your offering from the herd or from the flock. If the offering is a burnt offering from the herd, you shall offer a male without blemish. You shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting for acceptance in your behalf before the Lord. You shall lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be acceptable in your behalf as atonement for you. The bull shall be slaughtered before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall offer the blood, dashing the blood against all the sides of the altar that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. The burnt offering shall be flayed and cut into its parts. The sons of the priest of Aaron shall put fire on the altar and arrange wood on the fire. Aaron's sons, the priests, shall arrange the parts with the head and the suet on the wood that is on the fire on the altar, but its entrails and its legs shall be washed with water. Then the priest shall turn the whole into smoke on the altar as a burnt offering, an offering by fire of pleasing odor to the Lord. bugged me all week is like a pleasing odor. Shouldn't that say aroma? Who translated that into English? Pleasing odor. Odor's not a good pleasing thing. Whatever. First thing I want us to see as we're reading into these sentences, it's just in that very first verse. The Lord summoned Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting. The first verse of a very important book in the center begins with God. God is the instigator of all these things. This was not some humanly fabricated system. This was God's idea from the very get-go. And fundamentally, it's about relationship. And this is a really different type of system that these Hebrew folks that are in the middle of the desert that are getting this for the first time, this is totally different from anything that they've seen before. They've just come out of Egypt, where the relational dynamic of sacrifice was super different. It's been a minute since we've had a real good Venn diagram abound here, everybody. I just thought today's the day. We need a good Venn. What was it looking like for these Hebrew folks that are lost in the wilderness in this sacrificial system coming out of Leviticus versus what they've been used to watching everything go down in the nation of Egypt? It is wild, the crossovers that are here. I'm not going to get into everything that's on this list. I'll leave that to you if you want to let your eyes linger over these things. But there's kind of two big things I would want to draw our attention to. Who's it for? In both of these cultures, it's for God. Like, for Hebrews, it's God singular. Egyptians, God's plural. But the point of sacrifice is for God. And there's actually other people that get involved in these sacrifices. As we'll find out in a little bit, there are several sacrifices that are outlined where the purpose of those sacrifices is to share a meal, not just with God, but the sacrifice that's given. I was under the impression as a kid that anytime you gave a sacrifice, everything just got burned up on an altar. 40% of these sacrifices, you're making a meal to be shared. Sometimes it's a meal for the priest. These ones in particular are meals that are shared with God, the priest, and the poor, and your family. You're literally just setting a huge banquet table and inviting people to it. That's how you do that particular kind of sacrifice. We'll get into that a little bit later on. And that stands in pretty stark contrast to the Egyptians, who, if they weren't sacrificing to the gods, they were sacrificing to their beloved dead. The living marginalized versus the beloved dead. That's a big difference in how we're thinking about sacrifice. The other thing that's really different between these two systems is that for the Egyptians, sacrifices were given because they were trying to win the favor of the gods. Whether it was something of like, yeah, we really need it to rain, or we really want a great harvest, or whatever it was, the whole desire here was, I'm just trying to catch your attention for a moment, and if I can catch your attention, it's going to be because I'm giving you something really cool, and if I'm giving you something cool, then maybe the thing that I'm really like wanting and asking for, maybe now you'll give it to me. Which for anyone who's ever been a parent or for anyone who's ever seen a parent, when you've got a kid who's constantly trying to engage this way, this is what we call manipulation. Egyptians had this whole system of, if I do just the right things, if I give it in just the right way, then maybe you will love me. And that sort of relational dynamic, you don't even have to have been a parent to right away go, that sounds like trouble. It's not a great way to engage. That's just so much different from this God of these Hebrews who's calling out from the tent to Moses and saying, well, I'm going to initiate. And what I'm initiating here is not you trying to earn my favor. What I'm initiating is you're just surrounded by piles of mess and trash and ugliness. And I want to repair this relationship because that is standing between us like a wall. You cannot bring that into my presence because I'm God, I'm perfect. You can't bring that trash here. But I want to be with you. And so if that's going to happen, something has to be done about all this mess. And so he calls to Moses from the tent and he says, I want to be together. Let's figure out what to do with all this stuff. We have so much mess and so much brokenness in us. The Bible word for it is sin. And it's not just in our lives, but it's in our community as well. And so this is not a story that begins with us and really good human ideas, our desires to manipulate God to be how we think he should be or to do things we want him to do. This God is different. We've already got his attention. He wants to be with us. He's calling to us. And for those that are like, I'm on a spiritual journey, like, I don't know what I think about this Jesus. I just, man, if there's nothing else that you walk away with today, it's that the God of this story is a God who already wants to be with you. So that's our first point, this first big idea. The second big idea, and I want us to see this pops out right away in verses 3 and 4. It's this idea that we're getting near to God. That's the emphasis. The emphasis here is not so much getting rid of sin, and this is wild. Let's enjoy this together. It says this. Verses 3 and 4. Bring an animal to me. You shall lay your hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be acceptable in your behalf as an atonement for you. The bull shall be slaughtered before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall offer its blood, dashing it all over the altar. If we're going to understand like this idea of sin and brokenness and like what's up with the sewer system and the trash system and like how, where did all this come from, it's really helpful to go back to the beginning and understand the origin story of sin. And I do think it's important. We're just going to read it together today. Again, it's only a handful of verses, four verses back in Genesis 3. But I want you to hold on to these as we're trying to understand the sacrificial system. At this point in the story, if you've never heard this before, God makes Adam and Eve amazing. He puts them in this garden. It seems from the context that every day they just walk together. Their first day on the job was a Sabbath day, just a day to enjoy the world. And there was one thing that God said, well, there's these two trees in the middle of this garden. One's the tree of life. One is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that's my tree. You may not eat from that tree. It's like the one thing. And sure as shooting, one day Eve has a conversation with a snake. Wild story. Ends up taking a bite, offers this fruit to her husband. He takes a bite, and the one thing that they weren't supposed to do, they do. God goes walking in the garden the next day, and he says, where are you guys? They're hiding. And that was not the dynamic before. And he calls them out of hiding, and they were afraid because they realized they were naked. And it says this in chapter 3, verse 21. And the Lord God made garments of skin for the man and for his wife, and he clothed them. And then the Lord God said, see, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And now he might reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever, which is a great concern. We now have a messed up creature that could actually be eternally messed up. We need to intervene. Therefore, the Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed the cherubim and a sword flaming and turning to guard the way to the tree of life. He kicks Adam and Eve out of this Garden of Eden after he makes clothes for them. Beautiful poetry. There's this angel with a flaming sword that stands guard at this Garden of Eden. That's interesting. What's going on here? Adam and Eve couldn't remain in God's presence because of their sin. The same thing that we see going on in Leviticus. Now there's just trash and sewage just piling up around them. There has to be some sort of distance because that cannot coexist with this God. So he creates this distance with them. But it shouldn't escape our notice that they had sinned, that there was shame, and that in their shame, in their sin, that it was covered up by God in Eden before they left. I would expect this story to go much more along the lines of, where were you? We hid because we were naked. Bam, you're just thrown out of the house. Now we can do business out on the curb, but you can't be in this house unless you got it together. And that's not the order of events here, and it's so important. He clothes them in the garden. He covers up their shame inside the garden. And then there's a conversation, and then thank goodness they weren't allowed in there to eat from this tree that would have them live forever in a broken body. This would seem to be the life goal of any human. It's no accident that the pictures of the new earth that we get in Revelation included clothed people who are with God. why aren't we naked in heaven like Adam and Eve were in Eden? Why are we still covered? The goal of life, it would seem, is to enter clothed back into Eden, back into heaven. Regardless of what we have, we have this man and this woman who are covered with the skin of a slain animal. That's the picture coming up in Genesis 3. So to get back to this place, not only must we have a slain animal in the mix, but also something that will pass through this flaming sword, something that will pass through this fire. So what we have to understand in these verses in Leviticus, in verse 4, you lay your hand on the head of the animal. This is a key ingredient to understanding how's this section working. This is like the ancient Middle Eastern way of putting your signature at the bottom of a document. Lay your head on the hand of a thing. I'm putting my name on this animal. All of who I am. This is like not just transferring your sin. This is like transferring your personality. Everything of who you are. So while your signature, like on a mortgage, that's not you, but it represents you. It represents you in a place that you can't go and be all the time. That's the idea of what's going on here. To put your head on the animal, it now represents you. So we've now got our animal skins. And we get this weird detail. And for those that are like, I'm going full bore on this whole Leviticus thing, and you're going to read the first 8 chapters this week, or maybe you want to just read the whole thing, you're going to see over and over again with each of these different offerings that is outlined, turn it into smoke. Turn it into smoke. Verse 9 here, the priest shall turn the whole into smoke on the altar. What is this about smoke? There's a couple things going on here. And I want to paint the picture for you a little bit. So here's the scene of what's going on. This is what the tabernacle would have looked like. Give me that one, Chantel. Yeah. So I think it's really cool, too, in the top, these two squares. The top square is an American football field. The next square below that, that's the size of this thing. So just to scale it for you a little bit, I mean, we're talking like the 40, 45-yard line. This thing is massive. And as we get an idea, and he says, bring it in front of the tent of meeting, where you see this little, like, barbecue grill going on. Happy Father's Day, everybody. That's what we're talking about. So give me this other picture, Chantel, of this altar. This is a rough idea of what this would have looked like, and there's some key things I just draw your attention to. There's just grates on all side of it. This thing was 7.5 feet by 7.5 feet by 4.5 feet tall. The best, like what is that I can give you is it's bigger than a king-size mattress. So if you can picture that in your head, this is a big barbecue. Like, I am interested. This is awesome. And why would it be that big? Well, because oftentimes some of the things we're sacrificing are as big as, I don't know, a bull. And so if we're going to put the whole bull on there, it just needs to be able to fit. And you can imagine, for anyone who's ever grilled with like actual wood, if you've been camping, if you're stacking up wood, sometimes that wood can fall as it's like burning. And so if you've got a sacrifice on there and you've got this bowl and it's on top of a whole bunch of wood, this mound of wood, and all of a sudden one side crumbles, you don't want that sucker falling off the side. And so you'd have these horns that are on the side of it. And that's actually where you'd tie down the sacrifice to make sure that it wasn't just going to roll off. That'd be a really embarrassing moment. So remember this flaming sword that's going on in Genesis 3. If we're going to enter back into this place of Eden, back into this place of relationship with God, we have to pass through fire. So we now have this ingredient. But why is it so keen on smoke? Turn it to smoke. Oh, I got him. What happens to smoke? What is smoke? On a molecular level, it's just a physical thing that's been turned into a different substance that can now defy gravity. It rises. It becomes an aroma. The other thing about smoke that's really weird, and this is why my oil diffuser is really struggling. It feels like it should be much more robust than it's doing right now. But it is smoking. Is that you get smoke that comes up, but it dissipates. It becomes something that's still here, but you just can't see it anymore. And if you would come within about 3 feet of where I'm standing, you would smell something. This particular day and what's in here, this is the smell of the anointing oil. This is what would be all over the hands and the beards of the priests. So as you're going through these ceremonies, this would be the smell that you would be smelling in these particular areas. This is I hope a fun invitation for today, but for those of you who are in or near the front rows, there's some vials that are on the corners of each row. If you're in the front, will you grab those and just unscrew the tops and pass them around? But this is just what that anointing oil smells like. If you want to rub some on your skin and just smell it. I just think it's so important to like feel the idea that's going on here. Once it's on your skin, once it like kind of seeps in, you can't see the oil anymore, but you can still smell what's going on. It's just like smoke. Once you burn the thing, it's gone, but it's not really gone. If you've ever been to a really good barbecue, you can smell the brisket a mile away. I mean, I don't know that the brisket's there, but I can smell the brisket. It's that idea. What's going on with smoke? Why are we turning it to smoke? Well, it's still there. You just can't see it anymore. It's gone to a different place, something I can't see with my eyes, but I'm still experiencing it. Man, y'all, the Lord just leveled me this week getting ready for this, of saying, yeah, because that's where I am. I'm everywhere, unseen, and yet deeply tangible to you. Why are we turning this to smoke? Because we're giving it over to God. We're giving it to the place where God is. As you smell this all day today, I hope that it just continues to bring you back to this idea of, I can't see it anymore, but it's everywhere. Imagine a whole place, a 45-foot-long football field with aroma just pouring out of it. This is a really different take. This whole idea of an animal laying your hand on its head, this is a different take on how we as Westerners understand sacrifice. Because what I was taught as a kid was that if you're going to do something like this, you're transferring just your sins onto this animal, and then we've got to kill the sins, and then the sins are gone. And we're going to get into that. For those of you that are like ultra-reformed types, I don't want to freak you out. Like, that's there. We're going to get to that in a few weeks, particularly as we get into atonement. But that is not what's going on here. I think we got there because a lot of our tradition, a lot of our theology comes from reformers like John Calvin and Martin Luther, who were like trained lawyers. And they were trying to think through a judicial lens of like, there has to be a punishment for the sin. And that's fine. That's not the concern of what God has going on here in Leviticus 1. Here, it seems that God is less concerned with trying to solve the problem of sin and far more concerned with trying to solve the problem of our relationship with Him, the distance that we've put between ourselves and Him. In this system, in this kind of burnt offering, I'm not transferring my sin onto the animal. That's a misconception. I'm transferring everything of who I am onto this animal. And this kind of sacrifice, I'm putting my signature on it so that this animal can pass through fire and become smoke and go to the place where God is. These animals and sacrifices, it's an innocent animal. It didn't commit the sins. It hasn't created the waste that I've created in my life. It did not deserve that. It's going in my place. But because it is blameless, it can enter back through this flaming sword and back into this place of Eden. I am covering myself in an animal skin and hiding in that animal skin as I go where the animal is going, back into relationship with God. And it's a momentary thing. When this animal is burned up, like, there is a withdrawal back from this place. But man, the difference that this creates in what's going on here, it's so fundamental. And I feel real strong teaching and standing on this idea, really, because any of these sacrifices, the Hebrew word for this is korban. It's the Hebrew word for draw close or to bring near. God is literally saying, bring me an animal. Bring me a come near thing. Bring me something that allows us to be together. This is not a bring me a kill your sins thing. It's a come near to me thing. So if God's calling to Moses, if all of these are God's ideas, what does this do to our image of God? It's not some angry judge trying to demand death and gore, obsessed with all the ways that we're screwing up. This God, He's calling us from the place where He still is, the place that we left behind, that we chose not to be, and He's making for us a way to come back to be with Him. That's His idea. That's not something we are straining to do. God wants to be with us. He's calling us home. The third thing, and this I just want to right out of the gate say, I'm stealing this from a guy named Rabbi David Foreman. This dude is brilliant. But this third big idea is that getting near to God engages us with a journey. As we try and understand these sacrifices, these seven chapters are going to outline three main types of sacrifice. Only one of those categories is mandatory, but all are a form to deeper worship. I'm going to move really quickly through this, and then we're going to get into some main points. If you're like, I want more of that, feel free to send me an email. I can send you all kinds of stuff that'll blow your mind. But three main categories of offerings that we get in these first seven chapters. The sin offering or the guilt offering. In Hebrew, these are the hatat or the asham. These are mandatory. These are sins that I commit against God or that I commit against my neighbor. I have to give a sacrifice for those things. That sin has to be covered, just so that I can be drawn near to God. So that's kind of this base layer, this most simplified form of sacrifice. That's the only category that's mandatory. Everything else from here is optional. This second level, optional, the peace offering or the grain offering. This is where we get a festival like first fruits that we've just talked about back in our money series. It's called the shamim or the minha. This is voluntary, and this is the type that's a shared meal. That when I bring grain or when I bring an animal, the idea here is not just turn it all into dust and ash, but the idea is barbecue that thing. We're going to burn some of it, because that's God's, because he's joining us for this meal. But some of that is going to be food now that I'm going to share with the priest. Some of that is very clear. For the marginalized and the poor, the alien, the orphan, and the widow in my community, I'm inviting them to my table to eat this meal with me too. I mean, imagine this meal where you're sitting down with people from all over your town. You've got the poor homeless dude at the end of the table. You've got some that you know, like, we gave that to God. You've got the priests sitting right there and your whole family. And this is a ritual sacrifice. Mind-blowing. That's what God's asking for here. And then you've got this highest level, I think I can say, of ritual sacrifice. It's called, it's another sin offering. It's called the olah. This is a voluntary act for unintentional sin. This is a burnt offering. Every time we're going to offer olah, we're burning the entire thing. This is actually where God is starting in Leviticus chapter 1. We're going to burn the whole thing up. And it's this idea that expresses devotion or surrender. I am giving you everything. And the big idea that's driving behind each of these kinds of sacrifices is relationship. There's a purpose that causes us to wonder what's going on here. And so, again, this is really fast. But if we're thinking about this hatat asham idea, it is mandatory. You have done a wrong thing either to God or to another human being. You have to own up to that. The relational dynamic that's going on there, if this is God asking this of us, is I'm just asking for some respect. Like, there was fruit on that tree that was mine and you took it. I'm just asking you to repay it back. Take something of yours and give all of it back to me. That's what I'm asking for. It's wild, just as a fun aside, if I have a wrong done against a neighbor, not only am I like righting that wrong, giving back, like this is the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. What did I take or do to you? I am repaying it. God doesn't just say pay it back equal for equal. In this type of sacrifice, it's give it back plus 20%. Interesting ethical idea. But at the baseline, whether it's God or people, he's just saying, do you respect when you've stolen something, when you've taken something that's not yours, will you offer it back in whole? It's just common courtesy. That's respect. That's a relational dynamic. And that's really different from this idea of what's happening in this middle kind of sacrifice, the shamim or minha. The root word of shamim is the word shalom, this idea of peace. I'm just looking for harmony in our midst. And you can picture it in that picture of the table with everybody sitting around. What's the relational dynamic going on there? Well, it's just love. I just want to be together. That's what's going on at that level. And then at this final level, the burnt offering, the whole thing is being burned up. Awe is the relational dynamic here. I'm not just returning something to you that I stole and making sure that the accounts are accurate. It's a moment of going, man, there's things in my life that just belong to you. I'm giving them back. It's not that I wronged God with this kind of a sacrifice. It's just I owe you everything. And so at different stops along my journey, I'm finding myself going, oh, I have to give that, not just in part, but all of it back to God. My house is not my house anymore. So I'm going to offer back hospitality and all the hospitality I can manage. My marriage is not my marriage anymore. This is not about me getting my fix. But this is about giving everything over to you. Whatever the attachments that we carry along in life, this Ola type of awe offering, saying, I'm giving everything back. Last year, we had this series that we spent walking through the spiritual journey or the critical journey. And I would just posit to us, etched in these different types of sacrifices, is this invitation from God to something similar. He's saying, as a dad who loves us, I don't just want respect. Like, what sort of fatherly relationship only wants respect? I want love. And I'm going to make that one voluntary. I'm not demanding love. I'm just saying I'm offering that to us. If you'd like to respond in kind, we can have a relationship that's oriented around love. But this is also not just some dude. This is not a typical relationship. This is the God of the universe. And so again, as a voluntary level, he's saying you can opt in, but I'm asking for everything. Everything in your life, everything that you're attached to, I want you to give it all back to me. And that demands some level of awe. These are our big three ideas as we go through what does it look like to study ritual sacrifice? What was God doing here? God was really keen about repairing a relationship. This is about getting near to God, and this is more than just mandatory rules. So what do we do with a teaching like this? I think it's actually pretty easy, and it can actually reflect these three big ideas. The first idea would maybe be this. How do you draw near to God? What does that look like in your daily life? And I think for me too, y'all, like it's one of those questions that also has me wondering, where am I trying to manipulate him like a good Egyptian that I am? And where are the places where I just want to be near him? And I do wonder at things like a rule of life or what spiritual rhythms I'm pursuing. And if you're like, I don't know how to draw near to God, man, I would just encourage you, find a mentor. We'd love to help set you up with something like that. If you're not in a life group, this is a great place to discuss things like this. Could it be that there is something that you hold on to that God is asking you to let go of so that you can have more of him? Draw near. The second thought would be this, engage in confession. Like Dorian Gray, like our trash and waste systems, we're so good at like, it's out of sight, out of mind. I never have to worry about it or think about it. And the gift of confession is that it's time set aside to say, look at this mess. And then something can be done about this. I don't just have to pile it up either on my own doorstep or on somebody else's. Something can actually be done with this. What a gift to be able to name it and call it out and to confess it. Jesus' death on the cross. I mean, this whole system, and we're getting to it the closer we get to these weeks on atonement, but man, this is all about Jesus Christ. He's doing something about this mess that we've made. And then finally, I've wrestled all week with this. Which comes first, voluntary sacrifice, this burnt offering, or awe? Do I have to be in awe and then I give the sacrifice? Or do I give the sacrifice and then I'm in awe? And I think it's a total and chicken and egg thing. There seems to be an invitation not just to respect and follow the rules, but that God really is about relationship here. It's voluntary, which means you can always share some, and that later you can always share more. So how do we watch how Jesus does this? Is it time that you spend volunteering? Is it your money and your possessions? Is it the attention that you give him in prayer? What does it look like to live a life of awe? We're going to move into a time of communion as we wrap up this teaching. So for those who are ushers, you can begin passing the elements. But Leviticus is a whole book. We talked about this last week. This is a book that is reminding us that we are all priests. And part of the ceremony for priests before they would engage a sacrifice is they would wash their bodies and then they would cover their bodies with oils, with an aroma to remind them of something that they could not see but was absolutely there. So maybe as you hold these elements today, you remind yourself by just smelling the aroma that is on your skin. You might not be able to see them, but you can sense the effects of God everywhere. The smell of the temple for sure included the barbecue smells, all of the animal things that were going on, the smoke, the invisible. As you handle these elements of the sacrifice that was made on your behalf, this is a reminder that on the night that Jesus was betrayed, he took a piece of bread and he broke it, a grain offering, something voluntary, handed it to his friends and said, "This is my body that's about to be broken for you on a cross. Every time you eat this, remember the sacrifice I made on your behalf." And later on in the meal, he took a cup, and this cup represented a covenant, a promise and a vow made from God to us. And he says, "This cup, the vow that God's making, this is my blood. And voluntarily, I'm choosing to go to the cross as your sacrifice. Every time you drink this, remember me." And it's just so cool, like the way that you have to eat food is you have to lay your hands on it. There's almost an invitation here that I don't think is a stretch from Leviticus. I don't think it's a stretch from the Last Supper, where Jesus is saying, "Hold these elements, put your signature on these elements. Put your name on me, because I will be the thing that covers you. And I will be the thing that goes through the fire. And I will be the thing that is turned into smoke so that you can re-enter into right relationship, into Eden with God." As you hold these elements, consider your signature being put on them and the place that they will go. Hold these elements, and then I'll come and we'll receive them together.